Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The political pace is picking up as we close 2023 and quickly round the corner to the March primary, which means the stakes are on an upward trajectory, with every political decision and move carrying more weight. A tool to gauge how voters are feeling are polls. They are far from an end-all be-all, but they do play a role in checking the appetite for candidates and elected officials. The UC Berkeley Institute for Governmental Studies is the state's oldest public policy research center, which can provide more context when looking at percentages in a snapshot of time. A new poll out this month among California voters highlights challenges for President Joe Biden and Governor Gavin Newsom. For the first time during his presidency, Biden's disapproval rating is higher than his approval overall. And Governor Newsom isn't faring any better. In a rare show during Newsom's two terms, more voters disapprove of his job performance. And although unlike Biden, Newsom is not running for governor in 2024, it can shape his influence on the national stage. Dustin Gardner is Politico's California Playbook co-author and joins us with more about this recent poll, among other political current events. Hey, Dustin, how's it going? Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky. Good to be with you.
So, big picture, given your perspective as a journalist focused on state politics, what is the bigger message that you're getting from a recent poll about both President Biden and Governor Newsom's job approval ratings among California voters?
Yeah, I mean, I think both of their numbers are down pretty considerably. And like you said, this is the first time we've seen President Biden underwater in California with his approval ratings. So some pretty jarring numbers. And I think there's a couple of parallels where both the governor and President Biden have run into some problems, especially with Democratic voters. The one that really leaped out to me from this Berkeley Institute of Governmental Studies poll was the Israel-Palestine conflict, the war between Israel and Hamas. That really jumped out as an issue where Democrats surveyed in the poll, so they were frustrated with both the governor and President Biden. At least a significant portion of Democrats were frustrated with them. And that's maybe not particularly a huge surprise. I mean, California has some pretty progressive Democratic voters. And as we know, there's been an intra-party split among Democrats over the country's allegiance with Israel and just the response to the conflict, particularly around just civilian casualties in Gaza. So that's one parallel where the governor and the president were both struggling with voters. And then another parallel was just inflation and the economy. You know, we're seeing people frustrated with both the governor and the president about sort of their anxieties in that space. So those were a couple of similarities that jumped out to me.
Yeah. I mean, and to be clear, I mean, this poll doesn't indicate at all that President Biden is going to lose California in the general election. But is there a bigger message that his support among, you know, a comfortably Democrat state, at least within the past 30 years for presidencies, that it's declining?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, President Biden won the state by 30 points in the last election. He's not really in trouble in California, but the margin could be, you know, tighter than it has been. I think the poll had him up about 15 points over former President Trump in a, you know, hypothetical head-to-head election with the two of them. And that's 15 points is quite a bit different than winning by 30 points a few years ago. I think it does signify that progressives are frustrated with the Biden administration. I mentioned the Israel-Hamas conflict. That is a really biggie, especially with younger Democrats. The polling is really showing that younger groups of voters are breaking with the president on that. And also it just shows that, you know, there's at this point in the Biden administration, there's just a general level of fatigue with voters who feel like, you know, they expected maybe more, maybe a better messaging campaign around what Democrats are trying to do. And they just haven't felt a lot of energy and enthusiasm from the Biden White House, from at least from what this polling is suggesting. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was looking at the polling, I was surprised, or what stood out to me at least, was that, you know, among moderate and no party preference voters, that's where there was the largest jump in disapproving in Biden's performance. What does that tell you?
Yeah. So, You know, it's interesting. In California, no party preference voters had been the fastest growing section for a lot of years. And then now the portion of no party preference or independent voters has been shrinking while the numbers of Democrats and Republicans actually increase. And so, it's strangely a shrinking body of the electorate in California. But yeah, like you mentioned, that is an area where President Biden has struggled with voters in the state. And that, I think that really does reflect, a lot of frustration with inflation. You know, there's the federal government has been trying really hard for the last couple of years to get a handle on inflation. And while it's slowed, things haven't really turned around dramatically in that space. I think that's with independents and more moderate voters, that is the bigger frustration. And like I was saying, with progressives and other more liberal-leaning Democrats, there's a lot more frustration around foreign policy and Israel and Hamas.
Yeah, and during that same period, when it comes to former President Trump, his approval among California Republican voters, it has grown. I mean, in February of this year, it was at around like 29% of likely voters preferred Trump over the other GOP candidates. And now with this current poll, it's grown to 57%. That's just 8 months later. What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the biggest thing is the collapse of Ron DeSantis as a viable candidate in the primary here. Earlier this year, Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, had made a big play for California. You know, he had staffing here. And as his campaign is sunk nationally, DeSantis is pretty much pulled out of California in any meaningful way. And so I think a lot of people that were considering DeSantis have seemed to have gone back to Trump. And there really hasn't emerged another really significant viable contender, at least among California voters. You know, we've seen folks like Nikki Haley and others, the former South Carolina governor. She's emerged more on a national stage, but the polling doesn't show her getting much traction here in California. So I think among Republicans, at least, it seems like California voters are really hedging their bets with former President Trump.
Moving over to Governor Newsom, I mean, more California voters disapprove than approve of his overall job performance. And this is really a rarity in his two terms. I mean, going off of the same polling, the only time this has happened was in January of 2021. And we were in the thick of the pandemic during that time. And later that year, Newsom would survive a recall election as well. So what stands out to you about a declining approval rating at this point in his governorship?
Yeah, I think a lot of political observers and consultants in Sacramento expected the governor's numbers to be down at this point in governorship, a bit of time into the second term. That's typical for a governor to see their numbers lag a little bit. Jerry Brown's numbers were down around this time. But I don't think people expected Newsom's numbers to be down as far as they are. This poll found, you know, just 44% approval among registered voters. That's pretty low. I think his previous low point was that January 2021 poll that you mentioned. And that was just on the heels of the French Laundry controversy when the governor went to a friend's birthday party at a very expensive Napa restaurant where there were more than 12 people, and which was contrary to the public health guidance he'd given people at the time about large gatherings. So that was the previous low point. So I think it really was a shock for people to see this number below that. But, you know, I think part of this reflects voters not being that energized about him really taking on this role of wanting to be a more national figure for Democrats. You know, we've seen him traveling to other states and campaigning for President Biden and really taking on Republicans. And he has a debate coming up with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in a couple of weeks on Fox News. So I think some of the polling suggests that voters are not that excited about the governor focusing on this national role. I think, you know, it suggests that a lot of them would rather he be focused on concerns within the state. And this also comes after Newsom just traveled to China. He did a 10-day trip that was really focused on climate policy, but also some other diplomatic areas. And I think that could have been a factor in this polling. But a couple caveats I'll add here is, you know, there's been other recent recent polling, there was a morning consult poll in September that showed him with 56% approval rating. And that poll was among likely voters. The other poll we were discussing about was among registered voters. And so when you narrow the universe to people that are most likely to vote, his approval rating is higher. And that 56% approval rating just in September, that is quite a bit higher than the 44% that just came out in this Berkeley IGS poll. And so I think there is some head scratching going on and people wondering, you know, why was there such a dramatic fluctuation with his China trip and him taking on DeSantis? Is that really enough to send the numbers, you know, down that much? So I don't know. I think there are some factors to watch, and there is clearly some voter frustration with him taking on this outsized role outside of the state. But I think there are some reasons to be a little bit skeptical about the amount of fluctuation shown in the poll.
Okay. And I mean, regardless, Newsom is termed out and currently is not planning to be on a ballot in 2024. So some may think, okay, well, what does it matter if a larger share of voters potentially they disapprove of his performance? What is the impact of a perhaps declining popularity of an outgoing governor like Newsom? What impact could that potentially have even for the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I think it's very clear this governor is looking toward his future. He's thinking about, you know, whether he might run for the White House someday. He's made it very clear he doesn't plan to challenge President Biden in his reelection contest. But, you know, 2028, the campaign for that is pretty much starts after this next presidential election. And so I think, you know, Governor Newsom is looking at that very closely, and people in his circle are looking at that and saying, you know, how much can he be a national figure? And if his numbers at home start to tank, then that obviously does not help his case. And at one point, you know, not that long ago, he had the highest approval rating of any governor in the state. I think that was, you know, sort of in the middle of the pandemic in early fall 2020 or late summer 2020. So that's one impact is on the governor's future. But beyond that, I mean, I think these numbers, they really are important for the governor's ability to govern in Sacramento. If his approval rating really starts to dip, legislators will be looking at that. Other statewide officials will be looking at that. And, you know, that makes it harder for him to flex as much influence at the state capitol in terms of the budget and, you know, other priorities on his agenda. So I think, I think this is a big concern for him, and he doesn't want to be a lame duck prematurely. He wants to keep the political clout that he has in Sacramento.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dustin Gardner, Politico's California Playbook co-author. Okay, so all of this comes as the major APEC summit. It opened up over the weekend. It's currently underway in San Francisco. Why is this summit so significant, especially on the heels of the governor's recent high-profile trip to China?
This is a really huge moment for California in terms of just being in the spotlight of international affairs. The most watched moment of the week is clearly going to be the meeting anticipated to happen between President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping. You know, this comes after months of escalating tensions between China and the United States. And the tensions really started or escalated when the Biden administration shot down a Chinese spy balloon. And there was a lot of fiery rhetoric back and forth between Biden and Xi. And this moment's going to be very watched in terms of the ability to smooth those tensions. I think both sides have signaled they want there to be a thaw, and they want China and the United States to have a more harmonious relationship going forward. And Newsom, you know, his trip to China was very well received by the government there, and that might have sort of helped set the table for a smoother meeting between the two presidents. And so I think that's going to be the most watched aspect. And, you know, also there's just a lot of importance for San Francisco and California in terms of their ability to show that they can host this type of a world-class event.
Yeah, I mean, it's been more than 6 years since Chinese leader Xi Jinping actually traveled to the United States. I mean, what does a summit of this scale mean also just for San Francisco, its image as a city?
Yeah, I mean, this is the largest gathering of international leaders that San Francisco has hosted since 1945, when the United Nations Charter was signed here. To put things in context, at that time, the Golden Gate Bridge was the tallest landmark in town. It was a very different San Francisco without all the skyscrapers and the skyline we see today. And, you know, I think city leaders are really looking at this this summit as a chance to show the country and the world that San Francisco is still here, that it's still a world-class city, and that it's, you know, working hard to address the homelessness problem, the fentanyl addiction problem, some of the property crime problems, the things that have given San Francisco a bad rap and national headlines in recent years. So I think Mayor London Breed and others are really eager to put a, you know, a fresh face forward and show that San Francisco can host an event like this. And I will say, I live in San Francisco, and I've been walking around the area around the Moscone Convention Center where the summit's going to be held. And I've been walking around Union Square, and things are dramatically cleaned up for this event. You know, the sidewalks are freshly washed. You're seeing a lot fewer tents and a lot fewer homeless people wandering around. The police presence is very visible. So it's very clear that the city has put a lot of resources and emphasis into giving the best impression it can.
Before we let you go, I mean, it's also a significant week when it comes to the trial of David DePape, who is accused of breaking into former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home, striking her husband, Paul Pelosi, in the head with a hammer. This happened a year ago in October of 2022. He pleaded not guilty to charges of assault and attempted kidnapping. What have you learned from the courtroom? You've been following this trial.
Yeah, so we're in court today. It's the third day of the trial. Paul Pelosi is expected to take the stand, we believe, this afternoon. So that will likely be a very dramatic, intense moment. You know, a couple of things that we've learned so far. Friday, it was opening arguments between the prosecutors and the defense. And the defense, you know, they've said that they don't plan to dispute the police body camera footage that very clearly shows the attack occurring. They're not focused on that. They're focused on DePape's intent. And because this is a federal case, the charges require that prosecutors prove that DePape's actions with the assault on Paul Pelosi and the attempted kidnapping of Nancy Pelosi, that those were motivated by an intent to prevent the former House Speaker from fulfilling her official duties. So that's really the thrust of the prosecution. And so the defense has framed their argument around the idea that DePape, while his actions were horrific, in the words of the defense team that he has, they say that his intent was motivated by his true belief in the QAnon conspiracy theory and a host of other kind of wild conspiracy theories. And they're using that argument to say that it was not, his focus was not to prevent Nancy Pelosi from fulfilling her official duties. And that's a really interesting tact that we're seeing. And there are some similarities to some of the defenses we've seen, for example, with rioters who attacked the US Capitol on January 6th. And you know, their defense teams arguing that they were motivated by a deeply held belief system. So I think it'll be interesting to watch that whole argument around his intent play out in court.
Is this the first time that we'll hear Paul Pelosi speak publicly about what happened?
It is. Yeah, we have not, you know, we've seen, you know, some of the interviews with police and those records, but we have not seen Paul Pelosi publicly talk about this. You know, Nancy Pelosi hasn't said a whole lot about it herself. You know, it's come up in her interviews, of course, from time to time, but she has not really leaned into talking about this. And I don't think she's going to be actually anywhere near the courtroom today or this week. So it will be a very intense, emotional moment to see Paul Pelosi take the stand and talk about that moment of what it was like being, you know, woken up in his bedroom after 2 a.m. in the morning by a stranger holding a hammer. It's going to be an exceptional moment.
Dustin, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Dustin Gardner is Politico's California Playbook co-author. And you're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. PG&E is the largest utility company in the country, serving more than 16 million people in California, stretching from Eureka to Bakersfield, from the coast to the Sierras. If you're a PG&E customer, a decision this week by the California Public Utilities Commission could have an impact on your monthly energy bills and overall your bottom line. On Thursday, commissioners are expected to vote on a proposal by PG&E that could raise rates in the double digits. The numbers keep fluctuating, but PG&E initially asked for a 25% increase over 4 years to help pay for wildfire safety improvement, which includes undergrounding power lines. But ratepayer advocates argue that's on top of PG&E increases over the past 3 years, which outpaced the rate of inflation. State regulators have come back with proposals that are about half of what PG&E was proposing, running from 10 to 15% in increases. If approved, these changes will take effect January 1st. Either way, it seems that if you're a PG&E customer, you will be paying more for energy in the near future. Joining us to talk about what exactly PG&E is asking for and why the utility keeps coming back to ratepayers is Meredith Fowley. Meredith is a UC Berkeley professor and economist. Good morning, Professor Fowley.
Good morning, Vicky.
So let's start with where we are today, and then we can work our way backwards a little bit. Can you explain what is expected to happen on Thursday when the CPUC meets?
Yes, but you did a great job in your introduction. So as you mentioned, PG&E rates are high and rising and increasingly out of line with the rest of the country. So if you're a PG&E customer like I am, you've seen an increase of about 35, 40% over the past three or four years. And as you outlined so nicely, what we're approaching here is a PUC decision that will determine how much more. The question is not whether rates will continue to rise, it's to what extent they will continue to rise over the next 4 years. And so the PUC has a really important job. They have to oversee this regulated utility, look at the cost projections that PG&E is putting in front of them, determine whether they're prudent and reasonable, and then approve them. And then if approved, where do those cost increases or revenue increases come from? They come from customers. So customers like me, who will need to pay higher bills. And so as we think about these proposed rate increases, I do think it's important to keep two things in mind. So first, power sector investment costs have to go up if we want safe, reliable, sustainable power system. That's a fact that we have to sort of make peace with. But second, how we choose to pay for these investments is going to significantly determine how efficiently we decarbonize, adapt to climate change, and who's going to pay. So the upshot is, in my view, power sector costs have to rise significantly. We can't do anything about that. But what we can do something about is cost containment, how much they're going to go up, and cost allocation. Who pays?
Yeah. And I think that that's really the crux of the issue, you know, how much and who is going to shoulder the cost and the rate increases. So, OK, so the cost of delivering electricity, it's getting more expensive. I mean, one of the big reasons demands on California to electrify, to move away from fossil fuels. But what exactly does that mean to someone who's a PG&E customer and why they potentially may have to shoulder a higher monthly bill?
Yeah. So I think you mentioned one. I think there's probably three reasons why costs need to go up if we want the power system I think we want. The one you mentioned is really important. So we want to decarbonize. We want to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And the best or the one of the most promising ways to do that is to electrify, to convince Californians to stop heating with natural gas, start heating with electricity, to stop driving cars that need gasoline, switch to electricity. So that means electricity demand is going to rise for good reason, I think. But that means we need an updated, upgraded, bigger system, right? We need to replace fossil fuel generation with renewable energy generation. And then in addition, we need to expand the capacity, more distribution, more transmission infrastructure if we want more households and firms to increase their electricity consumption. At the same time, we want a reliable system, right? If I'm going to convince you to buy an electric car, you're going to want to know that the electricity is there when you want to charge it. Reliability is getting more challenging in the face of climate change. Anyone who lives in California remembers the catastrophic wildfire season. So if we want a safe, reliable system in the face of escalating wildfire risk, that's going to cost billions of dollars to design a system that can safely and reliably operate. And as if those two challenges weren't enough, at the same time, we've got high interest rates and supply chain challenges. So that's driving up the capital cost of new infrastructure. So it's sort of three challenges mm-hmm. at once that mean that it's just going to cost more.
Yeah. And on the wildfire front, I mean, the risk mitigation is expensive as well. I've been in the footprint of the Caldor fire where PG&E was undergrounding power lines. And this is a larger initiative across its really large footprint in California. What are utilities facing when it comes to wildfire risk? I mean, because the Caldor fire is just one example of what's taking place across, you know, a really large area of California.
Yes. So I think it's important to mention, and you mentioned it at the beginning, that like the primary driver of the rate increase we're deliberating over today is wildfire risk mitigation. So it's a huge part of the projected increases going forward. I think everyone in California agrees that PG&E should be focused on and invested in reducing wildfire risk. I think where parties disagree is the how and how much, right? So and I think the CPUC proposals that you mentioned at the beginning, so PG&E has put forward one proposal, and then we have two alternative proposals that are coming out of the PUC. And in my view, those proposals or the PUC commissioners are asking really important questions about what's the just and reasonable set of wildfire mitigation activities going forward. So as you mentioned, PG&E is really leaning on undergrounding power lines. So its long-term plan is 10,000 miles of undergrounded power lines. And to put that in perspective, this year we've done 197 this calendar year. So those are many miles. And it's expensive, right? So the PG&E estimates in terms of cost per mile is about $3 million per mile. So you do the math and we're talking billions of dollars. And I think PUC is arguing that this is the way to eliminate wildfire risk from utility-caused ignitions. And I think other parties are asking, you know, is that the prudent way forward? Given how much it costs to underground, we have other options on the table, other ways that we can reduce risk, perhaps not eliminate risk. And I understand, especially for someone like you living in a high wildfire area, the inclination is like drive ignition risk to zero, but that costs billions of dollars. And so I think important questions are being asked as to just how far we go to eliminating the risk and what the cost will be.
When it comes to actually like the dollar sign, I mean, do utilities mm-hmm. like PG&E, are they spending more than the state when it comes to wildfire mitigation? I mean, should the state bear more responsibility in this since it is getting offset onto ratepayers?
So you're asking a really important question. I think the answer is yes. Right now, the amount that PG&E is paying to eliminate or mitigate risk is larger. And I'd like to answer your question in two ways. So one, PG&E is spending billions of dollars to mitigate wildfire risk. If a tree or vegetation is managed around a power line, it shows up on your utility bill. If trees are managed far from power lines, that's on the state budget. So these are climate change adaptation costs that we are recovering on electricity bills. And I think we really need to think about the consequences of raising electricity rates to adapt to climate change. So I think one question we should be asking is, you know, should the utility be doing this much of the work or should more of it be done by the state? And a second question is, even if the utility does a lot of the work, where should those costs be recovered? On electricity bills or on the state budget?
Yeah. And the reason why this undergrounding has taken place, I mean, other utility companies have done this as well, like San Diego Gas and Electric mm-hmm. has accomplished that as well years ago, I think close to a decade ago. But this comes from aging infrastructure when it comes to PG&E's power lines. So why was this never really an issue before, you know, the last 6 years when we've had devastating, deadly wildfires? I mean, isn't the CPUC, are they responsible at all for just making sure that the infrastructure of the grid and utility companies that they oversee, that they're maintaining their power lines correctly?
Yeah, I mean, we do have aging infrastructure. And one of the reasons we're looking at high cost in the future is to deal with that issue and make sure that the system is up to the task. I think, you know, I don't understand the nuance enough to know, you know, how we should allocate blame. But I think the reality is the catastrophic wildfire seasons California saw a few years ago was a wake up call to all Californians, whether you're living in a high wildfire district and realizing you should do that vegetation management or a utility, realizing that there's a lot of work to do. So I think there's that was a wake-up call, and we have lots of sort of neglect to make up in terms of investments we need to make, and really important questions about how to do this, because I think it's worth elevating. And this is, the PUC decisions are 900 pages long. I can't pretend to have read the whole thing, but some really important questions about undergrounding isn't the only tool we have. There's increasing line sensitivity, there's covered conductors. So there are other options on the table that don't cost quite as much. And that's the conversation that I think is really important that California is having right now.
PG&E did send us a statement this morning, and just like an excerpt of it, it said that prioritizing safety above else, that is their mission and their bottom line. But they also say that undergrounding power lines, along with other measures, that it will actually save customers billions of dollars in the long run. Do you see that actually taking shape, given that the reason why you're here today is because of a decision to increase rates for customers?
I've heard that argument, and honestly, I don't have enough information to answer the question, but I think we should be digging deep into that question before we approve billions and billions of dollars that is premised on that argument. So I think there's just more that we can learn about the relative effectiveness. Mm-hmm. And if I can have one more minute just to sort of underscore why I think this is really important and worth, you know, everyone's attention. I mean, if you think about what we're paying for electricity right now, it's like 35, 40 cents a kilowatt hour. A significant fraction of that 35-40% is not the cost of you consuming the next kilowatt hour, right? When you run your dishwasher and you consume another kilowatt hour, that's about 10 cents. That's not 35, 40 cents. The big difference is all these capital investment, non-incremental costs. And so high electricity prices, one, are a barrier to electrification. When you're deciding to do natural gas heating versus electricity, you think electricity is more expensive to consume than it actually is. And two is affordability. Low-income households spend a larger share of their income on electricity. Mm-hmm. So when we're thinking about how to raise these needed revenues, raising electricity prices is a pretty regressive way to do it. It really hits lower-income households hard. So when we're thinking about how we need to recover these rates, so we need to contain costs, but we're going to incur costs when we're thinking about how to recover them, our current practice of putting them in the retail electricity rate, I think, is problematic both from an energy efficiency perspective and also from an affordability and an equity perspective.
Do you think it would help when we get our bill, just in mm-hmm. the spirit of transparency, that customers would able to see like an itemized cost appear on their monthly bills so they don't think that like the 30 or 40 cents is all because of using electricity in their house?
So I think information could be good, but I don't know about you. I don't want to spend my Saturday afternoon looking at my electricity bill. I don't look at it. So there's another proposal that is just briefly that is also in the works in California, which is to lower the per kilowatt hour electricity rate and recover more of this fixed investment in a fixed charge that increases with income. So that takes some of the pressure off the low-income households and puts it on the higher-income households. So I think I would prefer that because I don't, you know, information is good, but restructuring a bill to get the prices closer to right, I think, would be a preferred way forward.
Yeah, and often my bills just like kind of collect a pile on, you know, on the table.
And I study this stuff.
Yeah, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with UC Berkeley professor and economist Meredith Fowley about the expected vote this week on rate hikes for PG&E customers. So if you're a PG&E customer, you've already experienced rate hikes over the last, you know, few years. Maybe you are cynical, and if there's another rate hike, you're not going to be happy. And so if you're a customer and you think that PG&E is passing on the costs to customers, you know, while people in positions of power, CEO, shareholders, they end up winners with huge salaries, bonuses, and dividends. Is the customer wrong in thinking this?
I think the customer is correct to be frustrated. And this is a lot of money. So I think I want to give a careful answer. As I will speak only for myself. I am heartened by the Public Utility Commission really pushing back with really good questions. Is this really what it costs? We agree that wildfire mitigation is priority number one, but we have an obligation to ensure that we do this prudently and efficiently. So I think the customer should be asking really hard questions about why these rates are rising and is there more we can do to contain the costs? I also think some of these equity affordability questions are also important. Who's paying? And are we okay with the current rate regime? Or are there things we could do to make it more equitable, because I think if this clean energy transition is going to be fair, we need to be paying close attention to who ends up paying. So disgruntled customers, I understand. I am also a customer seeing my rates rise, and we should be really putting the pressure on to make sure that we understand what the cost drivers are and if there's anything we can do to achieve the objectives we have, which are really important, decarbonization and safety and wildfire mitigation. Can we meet those objectives more cost effectively?
Yeah, because you mentioned, lower income Californians, they take on a lot of the financial burden here. With your expertise, is there a more equitable way to cover the costs of delivering energy, safely and with the climate in mind?
Yeah. So as we were talking about before, and you've raised these really important points already, some of these costs are costs of climate change adaptation in the case of wildfire mitigation, or climate change mitigation in the case of accelerating electrification. So when we are incurring those costs and recovering them in higher rates, that's kind of like a tax. I don't want to use the word tax because it's provocative, but we're raising the price above what it really is costing on the margin to recover the revenues we need. And it turns out that putting this extra charge in electricity rates is a really regressive tax, really regressive way to raise those revenues. So one option, as you mentioned, would be to put some of these costs in the state budget. Wildfire risk mitigation, why is it on my electricity bill? Could it be on the state budget, where taxes tend to be more progressive than a higher electricity price? Or the proposal I mentioned, which has some momentum, restructuring how we recover those costs on electricity bills, so we're pushing some of the burden off of the lower income households who can least afford to pay.
Yeah, because it's all interconnected. Like if you're a SMUD customer in Sacramento and across the river in West Sacramento, you're a PG&E customer, your bill can look different. But if you maybe have a flat rate or maybe something that is built into the state budget or maybe arguably a state tax so that everyone kind of shoulders it and it doesn't feel as heavy of a cost burden individually.
I think that's exactly right. And when you think about where the current rate regime came from, it came from a time where the costs we were recovering were more sort of directly related to electricity consumption. It was the cost of building the power plants and the transmission lines. Now the electricity sector is so core to our climate change mitigation and adaptation strategies that a lot of the costs that are being incurred in the power sector are sort of broader costs associated with our climate goals and objectives. So I think the argument to put them on the bills versus other places, we should be thinking about those more carefully.
Is this just a California problem? Are you seeing this in other states as well?
Yeah. So California, is a leader for good and for not so good, right? So we are pushing the frontiers of climate change mitigation. We're on the front lines of climate change, given where we're situated and our climate. So I would say we are a leading indicator of where we're seeing some other states go. So our rates are higher than the rest of the country, but we are hearing from other states watching California negotiate these challenges, who see similar challenges ahead, increasing costs of climate change adaptation and the cost of the infrastructure investments we're going to need to keep up with electrification. So I think we are out ahead, but I think there are other jurisdictions watching to see how California meets these challenges.
Finally, given that it seems like PG&E customers, they're going to, shoulder another rate hike, which will take effect January 1st. We just don't know really how much, but that's really the topic of discussion for this week. Do you think that this is it, or there may be more rate increases in the coming years?
I would say there's going to be more. If you look and see what was in this rate case, it's only a fraction of the undergrounding miles that PG&E says that it's going to pursue. So I think we're just beginning. And that's why really, getting out ahead of this and thinking carefully about cost containment, lessons we learned today in terms of how to achieve that will serve us well in the years ahead.
Professor Fowley, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Meredith Fowley is a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Berkeley. Still ahead, the U.S. Forest Service joins us about their Christmas tree permit program and how it benefits both your wallet and the environment. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The winter holidays will soon be upon us, which means good people, good food, good times, and perhaps holiday traditions. For some, that includes getting a Christmas tree. Millions are purchased every year, but getting a tree today can be pretty pricey. A survey by the National Christmas Tree Association found that last year, the median price of a real tree was around $80. However, for people looking for a more affordable and environmentally friendly option, the U.S. Forest Service may have a solution. The agency recently opened its Christmas tree permit program, which allows many families and people to harvest their own tree in a number of national forests across the country, including several here in California. Here to talk more about the permit program and its benefits is Lisa Heron with Forest Service Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit. Good morning, Lisa. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Vicki. Nice to see you as well.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about the history of the Christmas tree permit program. How did it get started?
Well, the popular program has been, it began over 20 years ago as a way to offer families a traditional holiday experience while improving forest health by removing small diameter ladder fuels. And a ladder fuel is vegetation that allows a wildfire to climb from the forest floor into the treetops.
So getting a holiday tree at a tree farm isn't cheap. I remember one time, I think it was like a year or two ago, I thought about getting a Christmas tree and then I saw how much it cost and I was like, eh, maybe not. Maybe I'll plan this out better next winter. Why and how are these permits so affordable? Because they're just about 10 bucks, right?
They are. Permits cost $10 each. We do have a limit of one per family or household, and we are able to offer this because it helps us to remove these small diameter trees from the forest.
Where do the permits apply to? Are they for all national forests or they're just a select few?
I'd say most national forests across the country do have a permit program. And in California, we do have we have about 18 national forests in California, and many of those forests do have permit cutting programs, just like the Lake Tahoe Basin.
Yeah. Okay. So you're in the Lake Tahoe Basin. If someone wants a permit, how do they go about getting one?
So for the Lake Tahoe Basin, we are selling our permits in person. So you do have to come to our office in South Lake Tahoe to purchase the permit, and our office is open 5 days a week from 8 to 4:30. And you just show up at our office and purchase the permit. We are asking people this year to bring cash only with them. We are having a little bit of trouble with one of our credit card systems. And so cash only will make it much easier.
When someone actually gets the permit, they pay in cash, especially this year is very important to pay in cash and go in person. They have the permit. Then what do they do? How do they go about selecting and cutting down a tree?
So when you go to our office to purchase the permit, we give you everything you need. So we'll give you a brochure that has all the rules and regulations that you must follow. And we'll also give you the maps where you can cut the tree. Now, one thing I did want to mention, Vicki, is that you need to cut the tree on the forest where you purchase the permit. The Lake Tahoe Basin is surrounded by three other national forests. The Humboldt-Toyabe is over on the east side of the basin. The Tahoe National Forest is to our northwest, and the El Dorado National Forest is to our southwest. So if you purchase a permit on one of those forests, you have to cut it there. If you purchase in the basin, then you cut it in the Lake Tahoe Basin. And we have three cutting areas this year. We have two that are located on the south shore, and we have one that's located on the west shore.
Why do you think it's so popular every year? I mean, I'm just imagining the scenery. It seems like it's a beautiful way to take a tree home.
Well, I think it's so popular, you know, not only because it's the price is $10, you know, that's pretty reasonable these days. You know, you did mention the high cost of trees at tree farms and, you know, other places. So it is a very great way to get a cheap tree. And I think it's really popular because it does provide that traditional holiday experience of getting out into your national forest and, you know, selecting the tree. A lot of people make a family outing, you know, they bring hot chocolate and they bring all their kids. And it's just a really fun way to to see what the forest has to offer. You know, get out there, select your tree, cut the tree, take it home and decorate it.
Yeah, what you're saving in dollars, you're paying in sweat equity, I would imagine. So if it's your first time going out there to get your own Christmas tree, do you have any tips or advice? Is it as hard as maybe someone like me thinks it could be?
You know, it's good to be prepared. You need to make sure that you bring something to transport the tree. A lot of people will bring like a tarp and some rope so that when you do get out there to cut the tree, you can lay it on the tarp and then drag it across the, you know, across the ground that will likely have some snow on it. So that makes it a little bit easier. And then you can drag it back to your car. And, you know, most people, a lot of people use their regular vehicles and they put it on top of their car to transport it. And so that way, if you have a tarp and some rope, you can cover it up and tie it down securely to your vehicle.
And in addition to just it being a winter, a holiday tradition and just, you know, you can decorate the tree, but actually cutting down these trees, it's actually good for the forest too, right?
It is. As I mentioned at the beginning, the trees that provide, you know, Christmas trees are mostly smaller diameter trees. When you go out to select your tree, you can choose a tree that's up to 6 inches in diameter at the base of the tree. And that's actually a really large tree. Most people probably go for a tree that's maybe around 4 inches. So you want to consider that when you select your tree, how big it is and how it's going to fit in your home. And by removing these small ladder fuels from the forest, it does help when a wildfire moves through. We don't have all those ladder fuels that can, as I mentioned, that can carry the fire from the ground up into the treetops, which is really important because the way that wildfire can move through a forest, fire on the ground is typically good because it goes through and it kind of cleans up all the debris, you know, broken limbs and pine cones, pine needles, and other dry vegetation that's on the ground. So it kind of sweeps through and burns all that up, but it stays on the ground. Now, when we get fire that climbs up into the treetops, that's where we get concerned because the wind, you know, if there's a lot of wind, it can quickly move that fire from tree to tree. So it's really important to have a clear space on our forest floors, you know, that is free from this excess vegetation. And so the fire, like I said, if it stays on the ground, that's a good thing. And it's a lot easier for firefighters to get in and suppress the fire.
Yeah.
Once the fire climbs up into the treetops, then it can be very difficult to put that fire out.
The tree permits at the Lake Tahoe Basin, I mean, they already opened up at the beginning of this month, November 6th. I would imagine permits are still available. How long do they last until? When do you have to get your tree?
Great question. So I just spoke with our front desk staff this morning. As you mentioned, our permits went on sale on November 6th. And as of this morning, we do have approximately 1,100 permits left. So we think, you know, with the pace of sales that we've been seeing, we think they're going to be plenty available. So there is no need to rush into the office and stand in a huge line, which we've seen in past years. We're trying to let everybody know that we think we have enough permits that they probably won't run out. And we will be selling those permits. Let's see, we sell them, you know, up until Christmas. I'm not sure what that date is, but you know, you can still get one like the week before Christmas, or you should be able to, as long as we don't run out. And you may go out and cut the tree through the end of December. And the reason that we do that is there are some families, particularly military families, that may need to celebrate a delayed holiday.
I would imagine after Thanksgiving, things really ramp up for you in the Christmas tree permit department.
It does. You know, we typically begin selling our permits in November. We like to do it before Thanksgiving because we know people are ready to get out there and cut their tree. And so the time can vary, you know, depending on how soon we can pull everything together to be able to sell the permits. So this year we were able to start them on November 6th, which was great.
Lisa, thank you so much. It was great seeing you.
Great to see you too, Vicki. Thank you so much for helping us get the word out.
Lisa Heron is with the U.S. Forest Service's Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit, and we've been talking about their Christmas tree permit program and its benefits to both holiday goers and the environment. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Claire Morgan and Chris Hagen. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Monday. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.